everybody, and welcome back to the very final episode of The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie.
And this is Jakob. You already know this is a podcast where we do a deep read into each episode of The Wire. And as Willie just said, this is it. So,
yeah. So we're going to skip the whole anchor speech because, you know, the project is winding down. And we're going to forego that to, why don't you?
A very rare toast of not Protestant stuff.
Yeah, we got the Jameson out.
Not a whole, it's really, by out meaning we already finished it because it's a,
like barely one shot. Yeah,
getting crazy. Yeah. The shooter. Yeah. 3 ounces of pain.
It's like we're about to go on a flight or something.
Yeah. Woo.
All right. Cheers. Mm.
That's why I don't drink that.
Yeah. Let's start poorly assembling some kids' IKEA furniture.
No, we just have our dinner trays. Yeah. It's going to tip over. Spill everything.
They may or may not end up upside down at some point, and holes in the wall might appear. No.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So we're back in 30.
Season 5, episode 10.
Getting down to the real nitty gritty regarding this critical case theory with Carcetti and the big shots are in the mayor's office. They got called to the big dog's office.
Did they get called or did they call themselves to the big dog's office because they wanted to get out ahead of the scandal that McNulty made up the whole serial killer thing?
There you go. Sorry.
But, I mean, I get what you're saying.
Yeah. But EBP, Evil Budget Prez, really making himself well-known. But before that, more fun guy, Norm, is having a good time with the whole situation, just laughing, you know, about like commentary on the farce that it pretty much everything is, the absurdity of, you know, everyone's pretty much lying to get where they need to be. They're doing it on the campaign trail with manufacturing stuff from the situation that's already been manufactured by McNulty.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But it's pretty, it's a bit, it's funny, but also sad that Norm has kind of just been reduced to like the court gesture at this point, because like all of his good ideas are pretty much slept on in favor of Steintorff's evil dealings. So that like he's just like kind of reduced to making jokes about the road to Damascus and the commissioner falling on his ass and whatnot. So it's a little upsetting, but
see what happens when you leave the sun. It's nothing but, it's just like commentary on David Simon. Like, I used to do something that matters. And now look at me. I'm just, you know,
he's reaching into the next guy's pocket for it.
Oh, we used to make things in this country. I'm Norm. I used to, was he a photographer? No, he wasn't a photographer. He was, God damn it.
I can't remember.
We'll have to revisit this in the revisiting of our work.
The rewatch.
Yeah, we see. Yeah. After we're done with this recording, we're actually going to listen to episode 1 and take a drink every time we see. Every time we hear, see. We won't survive that. So, for sure. But see what? Yeah, he wishes he was at the paper. What's irony?
He could have like a more distanced take on it rather than just like constantly being in the middle of it and having to go at war with his own conscience. But do
you think that this is like David Simon? I guess wished that he would have saved Norm. Like apparently there's an editor who was influential in his career with the Sun named Norman Wilson, and he wishes that he gave that name, I guess, to Gus for season 5, but maybe like making Norman have some ties to the sun was his way of being like, oh, you know, it's like a little shout out.
Yeah. I mean, it could have just been like he wasn't fully aware of how they were going to, you know, concoct the season 5 storyline at the time that they introduced Reggie Cathy's character.
Yeah.
So he's just like, I don't know how to, I got to throw in his name somewhere here. But one thing, a little, you know, cinematic visual detail that I have to thank our friend Erlen Lavik for illustrating for us.
Cinematic Erlen Lavik illustrating for the masses. Ooh. Gonna get those film angles for you, please. Oh, sorry.
Oh, can you? What was that? What was the melody?
Like automatic, systematic. Oh, ooh.
I see. Yeah.
Earl Stevens selection.
Yeah, E40 ooh, sold smooth. You some wolf tickets.
To no, he sold.
but anyway, the episode opens with like a quick cut of like Carchetti at all different angles of the room, just totally violating the 180 degree rule with reckless abandon, kind of symbolizing like how Carchetti is trying to think of how this scandal can be approached from like many different angles, and realizing that he's lost and he's going to have to either cop to all this bullshit that they've been spewing or engage in a massive cover-up. So I thought that was a neat little cinematic trick that they pulled off at the beginning of this episode.
All right.
I mean, you can see that like Carchetti like doesn't know like what to say. Like he has no he has none of the flowery oratory skills that he has exhibited in earlier episodes when the episode comes to the press conference, and he's like, this is over. And I believe Bill Rawls, everybody, like he can't even like yeah. get through a whole like press conference because he's so mired in the bullshit. Sorry.
No, thanks for sharing that. Yeah. This is it. I mean, every little detail. It's anything's fair game, right?
I guess. We'll see. I mean, let's
you'll never see me with this microphone in front of you again. It's done. I'm retiring.
Yeah.
The pod dreams are no. Oh, who? My phone's are. Hi, Bill Simmons. No. You're still on Spotify? No. Have you seen Van's Twitter lately? No. Classic.
That was a funny joke that, or it was kind of weird what Van Lathan said on Twitter the other day about his mom and dad or something, but they did a great podcast about The Wire as well.
Yeah. So Steintorff is making some deals though, trying to get Rawls on board and Bond and everyone to just, you know, play it cool for the meantime, the election upcoming election. Governor's race, all that good stuff. But so, you know, he wants to talk to Rawls in private. He offers him basically the, you know, Maryland State Police job if he can just keep it under wraps. And he's talking about all the gears grinding in his head. And then, you know, remember after McNulty called Whack Daddy, Crack Daddy, they said he sounded like a gearhead from Dundalk. So, you know, gears grinding, Rawls grinding. Dundalk, I mean, is Rawls really, is he the one running around with ribbons?
Yeah, could be. I mean, he is a gearhead, as Steintorff dubbed him before offering him the state police superintendent position.
Yeah.
But
one can only dream. I mean, a lot of conspiracies.
Yeah.
But I've been trying to steer clear of that stuff. Just stick to what we know.
Fuck it, man. This is the episode to go all out. But anyway, a person who definitely has no gears whatsoever grinding in their head and who just looks totally deflated is Rupert Bond. he seems to have lost like all his confidence after what Gus dubbed the Clay Davis farce.
Yeah.
So he just seems like ready to acquiesce and agree to anything that's put on the table before him. Even like, but you know, he does have to like put a on a show of confidence, like, well, if Rawls isn't going to do it, then I'm out. Just trying to make a principled stance when like everybody knows his political career is pretty much already done at this point. So he has no leverage whatsoever. So he's just going to, it's a very sad thing to see. Like he was seen as a great hope, you know. Half a season or over a season ago when Rhonda Perlman was excited to work with him and whatnot. And now it's just really sad, you know, electoral politics don't do anything for reformation.
No more presidents.
Yeah, exactly.
Hang out with Billy Murphy and Clay Davis instead.
Oh God. Hey, you know, Martin O'Malley, you know, he would have been a good president.
Yeah. Too bad. O'Malley's March, baby.
Oh yeah, he used to be a band, or he was in a band. He was in a
Rock band, which I think that's why they always blast the Pogues, right? Because I can imagine they were like the anti-Pogues, just boring. But yeah, I don't know where you want to go from here. I mean, this is all intertwined with the police and the courts. You know.
Yeah, talking about.
I mean, yeah. Does that tie like Steintorff's like obviously making his agenda clear?
Yeah.
Carchetti's agenda, of course, is his. So he still is desperately pestering Daniels, even as Daniels is pretty much deciding his fate about the 10% crime reduction. Come on, just a little help, Yeah. Man, come on. We got gearheads running around. It's crazy.
It's like. We got gearheads running around. But, you know, it's kind of tragic in a way that Daniels is always like being forced, like his hand is always being forced to do the thing that's slightly not the right thing. And he, like the serial killer thing is kind of like the last straw for him where he has to like, in his words, swallow a lie. But, you know, with this whole thing behind him, towards the end of the episode, he refuses to juke the stats any longer. And he just gets it from all angles, from Steintorff, Nerys, his ex-wife. Man, poor guy.
Yeah. Do slightly not the right thing.
I mean, it's all in the, you know, he's like reluctantly taking the softer position to help shape public opinion, even though he knows like it's dysfunctional and that Carchetti sold him out. But he, yeah, I don't know.
If you bend too much, you're already broken.
Yeah.
It's like me, like a few weeks into my yoga cleanse. No.
Yeah.
My disc is done.
That's exactly like having a lot of pressure as a police commissioner.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Tough situation. I mean, just become, you know, it's always nice. You could just become a lawyer and, you know, who knows, maybe hang out with, like Levy and stuff. No.
Yeah.
You know, anyways. But what, yeah, also cops are doing more investigations. Lester is definitely far from a jester and he's there to pester. GDP, not gross domestic product, Gary DePasquale.
Yeah. Played by real life homicide.
Steve Geraci from True Detective. Oh, no.
Gary Diodario.
Oh, that's him again.
Yeah.
How many times has he been in this show?
Yeah, he's like shown up a few times, but it's interesting that they would decide to go with a minor character as the one who's the leak in the courthouse that's causing all this chaos amongst the lawyers who are hungry for the drug money.
Who shows up more? Gary D or Daryl the Boogie Woogie King? What's his name? Daryl Davis?
And like, definitely. I mean, Gary DePasquale has lot, like, seen like multiple scenes with at least like a few lines. And
yeah, so he's been hanging out in Atlantic City. He actually went with Marlo instead of Chris. So that's why he's three times his salary's been spent And I myself just got into a little, you know, situation with mybookie.ag. It's apparently legit. They may have frozen my debit card for a moment, my bank, thinking it was like some sort of scam. But my whole thing is, you know, those parlays and all that's pretty fun. I could see how it could just go downhill quickly. Yeah. But this guy's like, he's got leans. Man, yeah. Lester just, is he going a little overboard and just making his point known? Like, bam, bam, bam.
Well, he probably feels like he has to. He probably feels like the wall. Like, I mean, he doesn't know at this point that everybody knows about the serial killer concoction, but I bet you he probably feels desperate at this point to like do something positive after like being neutered so long within the police department. He's like, you know, if they're not going to let me prosecute Clay Davis federally, I'm going to bring everybody around him down. So
I'm going to take you down. But then at the end of the day, it's still like, oh, we're cop buddies. Like, you know, like you could do this the easy way or the hard way. Okay.
Yeah.
Just like, well, you know, we'll do right by you. Just make sure you call Levy. Yeah. Record him.
Yeah.
So brings back memories like that recording device. I wish very effective. You know, maybe, yeah, mid 2000s technology, but I used to have one of those and I would record you guys saying stuff. And I still have it somewhere. So
yeah.
Just remember,
you're gonna blackmail me.
Yeah, I'm a, you have a fake like shadow lean on your car.
Yeah,
I know everything, man. Anyways, we're moving along, making good progress here.
Thanks for keeping that under wraps all these years. I really appreciate you not ratting me out.
Yeah, well, you know, get a little half shot of Jamie and me, and I'll just woo. But anyways, you know, he's like followed the money all this time, Lester, and now it's followed the lawyers. Did you mention these guys? Like, he just starts rattling off names. Just like, so they really like how we're going to leave no stone unturned in this final recording. They have the same idea. Yeah. Like, we're just going to drop names, cases, just bam, bam, bam. So he's talking about other what can be perceived to be shady lawyers, Troy Sanders, Marvin Bronfman, Sid Silverstein. No idea what the hell is going on here with these names. Yeah. I did find one Troy Sanders in an old article. It was like a manager of this bar who was owned by the wife of a councilman named John Schaefer. She was named Joanna. And I guess they were doing some like illegal gambling payoffs back in the mid 80s. And yeah, I mean, it's like, seemed like a whole lot of, I don't know, just like people playing Keno or whatever. So like, you know, bar gambling games. So I have no idea how that relates to like high level shady, like attorneys.
Yeah.
And Marvin Bronfman, I have no idea. It's like a amalgamation or like composition of a couple names from just some random article. I don't know, maybe like one day he just saw this article. It was like Marvin, I forgot the last name, and then like Edgar Bronfman. And it's like these two people were named in the same paragraph of some random article about like an entertainment, you know, conglomerate. I don't know. Just like making stuff up. It's in my notes, okay?
It's in my notes!
Yeah, and Sid Silverstein, oh, let me tell you, A Light in the Attic. Oh wait, that's
Shell.
Oh yeah, sorry. That's
yeah.
Anyways, but there were like, we've talked about some pretty real people who were, you know, real attorneys in Baltimore who were pretty nuts, like William Purpura, who would defend people like Rudy Linwood. Linwood, Rudy Williams, and I think even that case had Savino Braxton involved. No relation to, you know, rest in peace to Savino. Yeah. And then, like, he eventually went on to defend El Chapo. It's like, hey, you defended Linwood. I mean, you can handle that. You can handle El Chapo, no problem. Or his firm did. But and then Harold Glazer was someone else who's come up a bunch. Defended guys like Reggie Gross, who was the boxer dude who was like on the scene with the, you know, War Against the Downers guy. Who the Jesus, my brain. Warren Bordley. He was the muscle and Donnie's like friend. They killed some people or something together. Who knows anymore? Anyways. Yeah. All right, Willie, help me out. Landsman still doesn't know McNulty set it all up. How the...
I mean, he might... Yeah, because...
How does he not...
I mean, I don't think... Like, it's hard to know by the end of the episode who does know.
Yeah.
Because, like, do we think everybody at the fake wake knows about it? The fake wake? like, shit. I mean, he... Kima told... Daniels, and then he told Perlman, and then they told the mayoral team with Rawls, I guess. I mean, we
don't... Hey, man, shit is like a war. Easy to get in and hell to get out.
Is that like another, like, Iraq war parallel?
Because they're talking about Semper Fi shit, and I'm like, oh, man, this is all, like, they're just ready.
Yeah, Landsman still doesn't know about it. He's still under the belief that there are WMDs in Iraq. I mean, that there is a serial killer out there.
There are ribbon WN ribbons.
Yeah. But so we have like a big reveal from Lester that to McNulty that like all the bosses know everything that's going on. And we see McNulty like really scared for the first time maybe in this whole show, and like
he's shaken.
Yeah. And he does share one tense last elevator ride with Cedric Daniels, featuring a surveillance shot. This is a Clark Johnston or Johnson.
The director? Yeah, Johnson.
Yeah, Clark Johnson did direct this episode, just like the pilot and some of the first season episodes where mirror shots and surveillance shots were more prominent. So this is a nice little callback to, you know, how everything is cyclical and we're always being watched, blah, blah, blah. Listen to our earlier episodes if you want all our analysis of that.
Erland Lavick.
Oh, yeah. What a great contribution that guy has been to the Wire fan base.
Yeah. This is like how every time we walk, or, you know, if I walk you out, if we're recording by me or, you know, vice versa, like how tense it is. And then, you know, to be continued, except this time it's like, woo, peace. We don't have to say anything, man. We might not talk for, no. Anyways, where are we at, man? We got to keep the ball rolling here.
So yeah, Lester and McNulty are like trying to parse out like why they haven't been arrested at this point, and they're both smart enough to realize that there's a cover up brewing because they're trying to save face given that it's an election year, so that eases their tensions a little bit. It's still quite a tense home life situation, at least for McNulty.
Yeah, it all comes back to the COC, man.
Chain of command.
POGCOC. Paso Glory. Chain of command.
Yeah, Paso Glory was a huge inspiration on David Simon.
Yeah, this is it, you know? Middle management, hell.
Yeah, really.
So, yeah, I mean, home life, yeah. I mean, you're alluding to he still calls Beatty's place home. After all these, I mean, I hope she at least like sent him to the clinic or like show me the test.
Yeah.
Because he's been
whoring himself around for sure. Or he's been promiscuous.
Yeah. I mean, that's a given. There's all sorts of other stuff going on. Like, he's got to deal with a copycat killer.
Yeah.
Who's
well, I don't know why it's funny, but
oh,
I mean, it is like we're laughing, but it's a horrible,
it's not, we've done that a lot,
dark satire.
We've done that probably too much in this, I mean, well, come on, we don't have time for this, like sentimental. Okay, well, we'll talk about SB abuse later, But anyways, not funny. Yeah, that ribbon shows up. It's not the right color. Jimmy knows something's going on.
Yeah.
And the higher ups, Rawls and Daniels, they're like, this is your last case, man.
Yeah.
Just solve this and be done. We're tired of having to deal with you.
Yeah.
And he solves it like Jimmy does.
Yeah. And it's a pretty, like, on a pretty, like, interesting little tidbit or detail that he picks up randomly from Christensen that the one of the victims had business cards on him.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, Ed Burns, like, actually said that was, like, a real detail he picked up from his police work, was, like, a random schizophrenic he had interviewed at one point, just had a collection of random business cards, so... This is not the show Jumping the Shark, everybody. This is picked from real life.
Oh, well, so is this from the investigation where you noticed wire, like, stalwart or, like, key, like...
unsung hero of the Wire universe, Fran Boyd, singing Love and Marriage under the bridge where McNulty finds the copycat killer?
Yeah, that. Thank you. Is there, what's the back? Like, what's up with this? Any other details? I mean, you're very detailed already.
But. No, not really. It's just something they mentioned in the supplemental materials of the episode. So, I don't. It's just a nice.
All right.
It's just like it's nice that she has like her haunting voice and all the steady work she did to help shape the outcome of the series. It's really nice to be reminded that she is such a strong force in shaping David Simon's worldview and Ed Burns, I suppose.
Yes. Jesus. This is great. wow, man, we're doing well here. It's a lot going on with the police.
So
pretty much wrapping. Yeah, I mean, Levy, you want to talk about Levy or?
Well, I just want to.
What else?
The final thing about like the homeless guy that they bring in.
Yeah. So
they wrap it up like remarkably quickly. And they bring the homeless guy into the box for a round of interrogation. And this is like a really special like location on the set that we've got to know over the last 5 seasons. And it's been like very integral to like the scenes where, you know, the details of the case are all coalescing and they're, you know, getting their shit together. But it's like really bittersweet in this moment when they're like interviewing someone who's clearly schizophrenic and whose like incoherent ramblings like may or may not be like a commentary on society at large or something. I don't know. I have a little bit of difficulty like parsing all that out. But it's like it's kind of ironic that this is like the last like major interrogation scene we see in the box. And it is of them like solving the case, you know, albeit it be something of McNulty's own horrific making, but like nobody can take any like pleasure in it or like have a victory dance around it because the circumstances surrounding it are so sad.
Yeah.
And like McNulty inadvertently like pushed this guy into doing murder. So
yeah. Yeah. Last episode, drinks up. No.
Yeah, but this pretty sad the, stuff.
Yeah. Thanks for your analysis of that. I mean, yeah, it's tough to watch for sure.
Yeah.
And yeah. So Levy has his sources, he tells Ronnie, which is a kind of a no-no. You don't really want to be the courthouse saying those things as a criminal attorney to like the most high profile you know, drug dealers, murderers in the city.
Yeah. And it's like this also comes after Ronnie learns of like all the shady lawyer connections and the leak from Gary DeBisquale from Lester. As tense as that conversation was regarding like, you know, there's some good news, but there's some bad news and some friendships are going to be tested. But yeah, so Levy and Ronnie. Yeah. he shows his hand too early, I guess.
Yeah, he does, right? I can't recall all the details from this scene, but she has a recording, so that's like,
yeah, she pretty has that damning in her back pocket, yeah.
And he's very sloppy, just like, yeah, money, yeah. It's like all the things that he has dealt with as far as his clients on wiretaps and stuff, yet he's like picked up nothing from how to talk, you know, over the phone.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's a whole different story.
I mean, he probably just has the, what was that thing? Like there is like a court case where a kid, killed somebody with his car, but he got off because of affluenza.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or because he is like so affluent, he didn't.
So white.
Yeah, he's so like rich and white privileged that he didn't realize the consequences of his actions. Is this like the thing with Levy? Just like assumes like, oh, like I'm in a different class, or like I'm, you know, it's not going to come down on me as hard. I can say whatever I want over the phone. Yvette's still going to make me delicious brisket.
Yeah, okay. He's going to risk it for the brisket. He did. Still got it.
Yeah.
So they do like quid pro quo stuff.
Yeah, and you want to jump to that?
Yeah, that's like, yeah. I mean, I don't want to, I guess, yeah, might as well, right? We're all over town.
We could go back up to that.
We can do, yeah. I mean, we got very versatile Google Docs to work with. Shout out.
Shout out to
show.
Google.
Yeah, come on the show, Google. Okay, but anyways, yeah, I mean, basically it's like, okay, the bot, like, common denominator always will be Chris just being in jail forever.
Yeah.
And, like, Marlo, 10 years, maybe not. Yeah. Just walk away, you know? He's got, like, not affluenza, but it's, like, psycholuenza. He's just, it's Marlo. It's like, okay, we don't, like, this case can't ever go to court.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, they have like a neat little, it's almost like a chess game of legalese, but they're doing against each other where they're like trying to figure out like how to let this play out in the eyes of the public. Marlo's like, or not Marlo, Maurice Levy is like saying that she's blackmailing, obstruction of justice. She's talking about like, oh, I'm going to get out of jail before you do. I'll buy the first round on you. There's like such animosity between them, but it's also like kind of like a weird, like professional friendly dynamic they have going on. Like they like doing this to each other. Very bizarre.
First drinks on me.
Yeah. So what do you make of it? Have they, like, they've always had like kind of like
a tension.
Like, but it's like adversarial, but like friendly at the same time. I mean, it's
all kinda, in the game.
It's almost like the same way that McNulty and Stringer would talk to each other at times, like they enjoyed getting a rise out of each other.
Yeah, it's a chase, I guess, or I don't know. I don't know what it like. I heard it's, you know, not that hard to become a prosecutor. Just don't do it, okay?
Yeah.
What we need is abolition.
Ooh.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, that's a whole different thing. Perlman, you know. Yeah, they're both pretty shady.
Yeah.
Maybe one's more, like, by the book, and, you know, she has taken her job more seriously, but it's like, you know, it's all one big club. Like, they would all run into each other at some judge's, like, fundraiser anyhow. So, right? It's like, we all live in this part of town, and what we deal with is over there, so...
Yeah.
Who cares at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
We're not actually going to go to jail ever.
I mean, they both play this scene out exactly the way you would expect them to based on like everything they've shown their characters to be over these last five seasons. Like Rhonda like believes in like justice and like, you know, everybody everybody getting a fair shot, but at the same time she's like a career lady, so she's not going to like, you know, say fuck it and like blow the walls off this whole thing and just go scorched earth, but she's still gonna show like allegiance to the higher ups. Like that's the whole reason like why Daniels refuses to sell her out or like go public with the whole scandal of you know, the mayor always wanting to juke the stats because his wifey will get caught in the line of fire, in the line of the cross, will get caught in the crossfire. I mean, it's just,
yeah, man.
Gotta. Yeah, she's not going McNulty in this situation, but she does. I mean, it's the best case scenario, I think, for McNulty and Freeman in this instance, because she knows how to shrewdly play the game, but still be quiet as a puppy walking on cotton. Dude, Levy's a snake, dude. Yeah. As soon as he get, yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah, he's a total. And I was just gonna say, and at the end of the day, they both like if this is failing, they're failing upwards. Like, I mean, Levy's only gonna get more business at the end of all this, and you know, more brisket, and going to the preserve to kick it with Yvette. Herc said, "You bet." and then she becomes a judge, which, like, I don't think that's a lateral move from the assistant DA, or
no, it's definitely a step up.
Yeah, right. So yeah. Step ups.
No. Yeah.
Good stuff, man. But yeah, Levy snake, man.
It's just so impressive with seeing him faced with what so many lesser, less conniving lawyers would see as like a death sentence in terms of their career, with that audio with him and Gary DePasquale. He immediately like starts to maneuver into this kind of like manipulative, well, I already said it, but chess game between the two of them, where they're both trying to damage control their way out of horrible consequences. It's very revealing but impressive scene to see, with great performances from Michael Kostroff in Deirdre Lovejoy. And apparently David Simon said he rewrote this scene the night before they filmed it, which is you know, makes it all the more impressive considering like all these different cases that all these different cases that Rhonda brought to life, like all the legalese, Everhart 274, Cecchellini. But yeah, that was a messed up thing that David Simon did, rewriting that the night before and adding in all this complex shit.
Yeah. Here's your new script.
And the actors have gone on record saying they struggled with some of this jargon before.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell him, man, how an actor must feel.
I don't know. But let's go back to
where. Yeah, what?
Yeah, we did the Perlman barters.
Fake quake.
Oh yeah, so McNulty has his fake wake. This is towards the end of the episode, and Jay gives kind of a beautiful speech about how if he was dead, he would want McNulty working the case. And this is like some of the, you know, all these scenes at Kavanaugh's, which I guess is not the real Kavanaugh's. It was a lesbian bar, so they said.
I don't know. You tell me. You look into me. Really.
But it's some of the most like unabashedly sentimental stuff in the show.
Does it make you like... you know, regardless of the clientele, and I mean, the whole background information is news, but hey, that's why we're here, right? Oh, it's like, you know, I know you have a fondness for dive bars and you sometimes need to scratch that itch. Does this make you like feel any type of way?
Well, I don't know. I feel like a disconnect with it personally, just because like it is a cop bar. Not saying like I feel one way or the other about it, but I just haven't found myself in that certain milieu throughout my life, so I can't say like, oh, I'd be excited to go to a dive cop bar where they would sing like these Irish rock songs.
Well, I don't know. I meant more like just a like minus take the cops out of it, like you saw like a kind of cavernous dive bar, not much window lighting, been like, you know, yeah. Just I know like in the past, you know like we've gone down the rabbit hole.
Oh my goodness. yeah that bar does definitely look very appealing to me.
Yeah, and given our background, like, you know, where we're from and, like, maybe coming of age and going to bars meant, like, it's a different experience, you know, if you're just taking, like, you know, the context of our hometown and stuff. This is like, you know, not going to lie, obviously a scene in the past where I'd like, oh, man, I'm getting through this case, man, of not investigation type case.
Yeah, like Sierra Nevada.
Yeah, 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 back in the day. And I'd be like, wow, this is great. Let me rewatch this scene. Like, they're singing the camaraderie, and now it's like, oh, depiction, endorsement.
Yeah.
Cop again. It's like, you broke the law. Just, yeah, we'll have a party.
I mean, but it's like,
yeah, it's whatever.
It's bittersweet because at the same, you know, who there knows, like, what McNulty, do you think Jay knows by this point? Or, like, do you think that, like, everybody in the bar knows by now what McNulty was up to with the whole serial killer thing? Because don't you think some more people would be more adversarial towards him? Because
yeah, it's
Rawls
like
did say, like, nobody's ever going to get overtime again.
And that, I mean, if there's, like, that, if people really want to reform the police, just take away overtime. No, that, there's going to be more than a sick out. No.
Yeah.
That is true. So, yeah, because everything's been kept under wraps. This is not like closure, really. It's just like, oh, they're leaving. They got in trouble, right?
Yeah.
And, like, we're kind of glad we don't have to deal with him anymore, but he was, like, he was good police, natural police.
I mean, they're all going to come up with their own stories as to why these two got shit canned, just like everybody is still making up tall tales about Omar's death. Like,
yeah, he had the AK.
The cops and the crooks have similar tendencies when it comes to exaggerating others' downfalls.
Ooh, my man. Anyways, nothing else I can say there. So,
well, I mean, it's at this party that Kima reveals to Lester and McNulty that she was the one that snitched to Daniels.
Yeah, and they don't even, like, Lester's just, I mean, he's drink at peace.
You
yeah.
gonna drink with me?
Yeah, drink with me, Willie.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Lester, what can you say? I mean, it's hard to, you know, I mean, thinking about crossing guards and lifeguards will get you a little aggravated, I know, but come on. Can't be all ACAB, even thinking about Lester, too, drinking and whittling away.
I mean, of course, like, he's one of the most fantastic characters on the show, but there's no two ways about it. He went about trying to burn the whole system down and maybe a wrong, unethical way by co-signing Jimmy's madness methods.
Yeah, and really good at prank calling. So if anything, like his dexterity, or I don't know, like his versatility, like his skill set, I mean, he can hack into like elaborate phone systems and like servers. Yeah, then he can whittle these like ornate little like what could come out like, you know, 18th century or whatever, Victorian era artwork
that he drives his girlfriend Chardine crazy with.
Yeah, but he's making like more, arguably more on the Antiques Roadshow circuit doing that than he would as a cop. I mean, OT though, don't let that OT that's huge. You know, you can make more than your base salary in OT.
I could definitely see Lester on an episode of Antiques Roadshow. That would be fun. I found it rather touching that McNulty and Lester didn't hold any grudge towards Kima because they kind of realized through all of what she's done throughout her tenure that she's been the kind of moral center. So I found it, I mean, it is like a little, there's some like moments in this episode that you could like regard as like fan service or whatever, or that like things wrapped up too neatly. But this is something that I felt like was earned throughout because, you know, like I said, Kima was the one that refused to finger Weebay when she was in the hospital bed. She's always decided that she's going to play things straight and clean. So I thought it was nice that she decided to commiserate with Lester and drink with him, but McNulty decides to not drink for the night and goes home, and in the process gives a man, a homeless man, a dollar.
Road soda. As in a real, like a soda. That's, I mean, I got Perrier. Ooh, just on ice. Can't wait to have some of that.
Okay, yeah, man. That sounds good. McNulty just is going home to wordlessly cuddle with Beatty on her front porch.
Wordlessly cuddle? He doesn't do Wordle. He does wordlessly cuddling. That's interesting. Anyways, that's like, we could talk about that at the...
Yeah.
Or like, oh, Carver, Lieutenant Daniels.
Yeah, it's really, you know, some really nice closure that Carver is made to. He's promoted to lieutenant, as Daniels is kind of like making his last act as commissioner before he's forced to resign. And this is also like a really another touching earned moment at the, you know, ceremony where Carver is promoted, because they have had bad blood in the past between them when Carver decided to rat on Daniels and company when he was like kind of in cahoots with Burrell, but I feel like they've both learned a lot since then and they've come to respect each other in a really friendly way. And I just think it's beautiful, but it's just tragic at the same time that Daniels is forced to step down and a rat fucker like Valchek is made commissioner.
He's going to go make Lieutenant Carver like write some more parking tickets down like at the cemetery where Frank is buried.
Jesus.
No, that's messed up.
Yeah, Valchek is pretty incompetent in everything. We've seen other police people be corrupt, but at least competent, you know.
There you go. You need some competency with your corruption.
Yeah.
Where are we at, man? About halfway through.
Yeah, this is an extended episode.
I need a road soda. No.
McNulty picks in his last act in this episode in this series, after he's shit canned from the police, he decides to go on a scavenger hunt from his homeless friend that he abandoned at a Virginia homeless shelter. And so he picks him up after conversing with the lady at the shelter, and on his way home on the freeway he decides to just park on the shoulder and take a look out at the Baltimore skyline. Like, it's a beautiful shot, and it, like, you know, encapsulates so much of what's going on with the series and whatnot, but this moment felt a little like upon rewatching the show as many times as we've had, it is a little like awkward. Like, can you imagine, like, say you're, you know, driving home tonight and you decide to pull off to the shoulder on the 134.
Yeah, let's look at the skyline of downtown. and then after gazing off at the skyline in an unsafe location, you tell your passenger, let's go home. It's like, yeah. Okay, that's where we were headed until you just decided to you know, randomly stop.
Like, are you it seems like you, like, are you psychotic? Are you just going to, like, pull over to the side of the road and walk off into traffic or kill me and fulfill your desire to become a homeless serial killer?
That's like McNulty's, like, he gets clipped and then falls under the overpass and survives and then just, like, becomes, like, a manic murderer. But talking about obscure news stories that we just bring up off the cuff, which will potentially shed more light on moving forward, let's get to the newsroom.
Yeah,
it's where everything is bubbling up. Oh, look, it's Reginald. He's on his, like, dentist quest at the moment, right?
Yeah.
Even though it's different. I mean, is that a, that's a very poor like analogy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like this. Man. Why did we wait till the last episode to have a taste?
But yeah,
we're recording this on the like railroad tracks, by the way.
Oh yeah, we're getting, it's very experiential. You know?
What is the meaning of this, of these tracks?
Now that we're here, I finally know what it's all about.
You'll never know. Maybe I could, you know, if people weren't calling me to tell me to stop tweeting, I could shed more light on that. You rubes.
You know, what's funny is that I was watching the Paley Center interview with David Simon and the cast and crew, and...
What is the Paley Center again? It's you like keep telling media, me this. I'm like, what
a,
the?
It's a media center in New York.
Okay.
But so I don't know. But David Simon talked about, like, he was like, I wish that I was David Chase with The Sopranos, because they interviewed him like all these times about like what this and that meant. And he's just like, I don't know, figure it out. But he was like, I've had to like explicitly state like what I meant with every twist and turn of this story, because we were always in danger of getting canceled. So I really had to sell the shit out of this motherfucker. But the one thing he's never like explicitly like said the meaning of is what's going on with all the train track symbolism. Yeah. But anyway, sorry that we're getting
that's
a little,
good. This is great, man.
Getting a little off topic there, but yes,
stay on track.
The the only, you know, story that we've encountered throughout these five seasons, that makes it into the newspaper that we've all thought was worthy of being in the news story was Fletcher's expose of Bubbles, not Prop Joe's killing or Omar's killing or the triple murder or drugs and the education. But at least there is like one small ray of hope with Bubbles's story having more light shed on it.
That is, that's a great way of putting that.
And it's a beautiful article. It's some real Joe Mitchell stuff.
Yeah. not sure.
Joseph Mitchell, the writer best known for his works of creative nonfiction he published in The New Yorker that primarily consisted of character studies where he used detailed portraits of people and events to highlight the commonplace of the world in and around New York City.
All right. Oh, this is later on what Gus has sent. Got it.
Well, he's like, it's some real Joe Mitchell stuff. It's beautiful. You just pulled it through the keyhole.
And, yeah, Fletch is getting a firsthand, like, you know, glimpse or, you know. It's tough. It's tough out there selling the sun to passersby. I heard the mayor's office is going to divert funds for outreach to people like Fletcher trying to sell the Baltimore. Oh wait, that's Squeegee Kid. Sorry, stand with in solidarity. But better to be Joe Mitchell than Tom Wolfe. wannabes.
Yeah, who is Tom Wolfe?
Yeah, you don't have a tab ready. Tom Wolfe. Yeah, there's only we really we did our best this episode to do it justice. Tom Wolfe is like it's he had come up with a certain type of journalistic, like more of a literary touch to journalism, did work documenting Ken Kesey. And yeah, I glimpsed at this, you know.
Yeah,
I had this tab open in a far reaching corner of my, you know, rotting brain. But anyways, yeah, so this journalist's work is like, you know, pretty revered, I'd imagine. Tom Wolfe, obviously I know nothing about. For someone who watched this season was like, oh man, this is, I'm gonna join my school newspaper and like, woo, yeah, like I know nothing. But anyways, yeah, Ruby Report is out. Robert Ruby was his name, or
yeah
okay, yeah. Gus's homie from abroad is done reviewing Scott's fake trout, and his nut graph is not adding up. It's like a sweater
with all the threads, with yeah, Duluth's threads hanging off of it.
There you go.
Yeah,
what's up with that, man?
I mean, it's a I mean, it's the logical conclusion to this storyline. We all knew that Scott Templeton was shady, like, you know,
yeah,
through everything he's done. It's only natural that he has a whole web of lies behind him.
Yeah, man. Talking about lies, he gets caught in a doozy.
Yeah.
He lied on the van.
Yeah, that's right.
There's supposedly a gray van that dropped off Smoke Hound, as they call him.
Yeah.
Drunk, I guess. And undercover cop is there, and he tells McNulty it's all a bunch of BS.
Right.
It's just amazing how, like, everybody's still so committed to their part in this, like,
yeah,
grand scheme where, like, the undercover is like, I'm not breaking character, and, like, you know, this is super important what I'm about to tell you. Like, I'm going to crack the case. Like, no one just stops and, like, what the hell's going on, man? This is so dumb.
Yeah.
Because McNulty is, like, not, you know. Yeah, I mean, if the top, if the mayor and, you know, the head of the police department aren't willing to, you know, break it open,
yeah,
why should one of the pawns on the front line do so, right? Even, you know, whatever.
They're not doing anything clean, like, you know, Scott published that Marine story without even talking to him, but Fletcher, you know, he's the guy that actually talks to Bubbles before publishing this and make sure he's okay with it, which I guess Simon said was against the policy of the Baltimore Sun to even, like, talk to your subjects before, you know, getting the stories published, which Simon said he always broke that rule. He would try to make sure, even like when he was writing The Coroner Homicide, he would let people read the stuff before he went through with it.
So. Yeah.
Scott Fletcher is a rare beacon of light amidst all this fake troutery of fake abductions and non-existent gray vans and nondescript 6-foot, not fat, not thin guy.
Not skinny. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, so this is all coming to a head. Or
yeah.
They're on a collision course, Gus and Scott, and... Scott says, fuck you, Gus.
Yeah.
What you gonna do about it? Nah. But
yeah, Gus was my grandpa's name, man.
Oh, shit. All right. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Sir. But Gus is bringing up some names. Interesting stuff here. I hope you got the tabs ready, because I don't. Nah, yeah. But he's like, you know, it's just like the Blairs, the Glasses, the Kellys.
Yeah.
And these are all... pretty prominent, you know, instances of plagiarism, really high profile stuff here. Stephen Glass, Jason Blair, and
if anybody, I mean, for check anybody out there who hasn't seen it, there's a pretty terrific movie from 2003 called Shattered Glass about the whole Stephen Glass New Republic scandal, starring Hayden Christensen and Peter Sarsgaard. So check that out.
I didn't even know about I got to check that out.
You show, it's good, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's on my to-do list. It's on the stat.
Nice.
No, I don't.
But
yeah, I mean, pretty interesting stuff. I didn't really know any of this, really. Yeah, Jason Blair made up some stuff about like churches and like the Beltway sniper, John Lee Malvo confession stuff. That didn't happen.
It always starts with something small.
Yeah, and something true.
Yeah.
Anyways, what else? That's the in my notes thing.
In my notes!
Yeah. So, I hope I get this straight, because it's in our notes.
It's in my docs!
Yeah. I wear my slippers with socks! So, there's a great talk that we may have linked already, where David Simon is pretty much laying out, you know, the entire... like inspiration behind the show itself, and then more specifically talking about season 5 at USC. It's probably happened like over a decade ago. And near the end, he brings up some interesting points about John Carroll, who was one of his, like one of the editors that he was beefing with, fonking with, you know.
It's Carroll and Marymow, right?
Yeah, Marymow. And talking about a reporter who wrote some pieces about lead paint and covered it really extensively, like leading up to the election, and just for like, you know, the calendar year 2000, basically. And I was always like, the editor wrote this, Carroll, because that's the name. He's like, you know, there was this one final straw that broke the camel's back with me, more or less. I'm like paraphrasing here, but where, you know, this thing happened and this is why I name names, you know. But I'm always like, is it this guy John Carroll he hates so much, or was it something else? And basically, from what I got out of this, I mean, it'd be much better if we could just like play audio like normal podcasts. Like, here's the audio of what Damon Simon said. No, we love to hear ourselves talk, or I love to hear myself speak. We're just going to like break down one of the most complex TV shows of all time and just freaking like sum it up in our words, yeah, hour by hour, episode by episode.
I mean, it's worked out great.
Yeah. I mean, massive following, huge Patreon. Like, we're just doing great. But basically, the whole like in my notes thing came or was like inspired from this instance where there was a reverend who was quoted in one of these stories by the reporter who we found out is actually Jim Hayner, who like wrote feature pieces about how lead is like poisoning, you know, people, and it was a mother and daughter in East Baltimore. He profiled
Barbie Crest.
Yeah, Barbie Crest things. And the story, it was about, you know, like the Reverend Douglas Miles and the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance, really powerful player. And like, you know, we talked about that on the campaign trail in previous seasons, talking about, you know, family member who had been impacted by lead. Simon said in the talk that it was like his niece. And then it turned out, you know, the governor was in town and they were going to have this discussion, but then it never came up because the governor, Gledenin, at the time was in town to talk about crime. But I think in reality, it was talking to build like this political organization about legislature stuff, and like no discussion of the lead ever came up. And then, you know, it turned out to just be this like, oh, it was an honest mistake. You know, it was in my notes. Like, this is what the reverend said. And, you know, but apparently it never happened. So pretty crazy stuff. But shall we, can you go to the, do you have the article? So I could just read off just a little bit to make sure that what the hell I was just talking about makes some sort of sense. we'll do just the quote about the granddaughter. Oh, we could talk about that next.
Wait, where's the quote about the granddaughter?
It's in the article. It's in the article.
Oh, this is the...
Yeah, that's the editorial. I could pull it up too. You have it open. So when he reached the Reverend Douglas Miles, the governor got an earful. I told him, two of my grandchildren have been lead poisoned in rental houses in this city, Miles said. So I take this very personally. Miles is the president of the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance, an organization of 200 pastors with a total of 20,000 parishioners, many of them residents of three hot zone neighborhoods that produce half the state's lead poisoning cases. And then this was from an article in 2000, like we said, from January 22nd. And then just 3 days later, this is what they published. It's pretty funny. Corrections. An article in Saturday's editions of The Sun incorrectly characterizes the purpose of a visit to Baltimore by Governor Paris and Gledenin as a fact-finding mission to the city's epidemic of lead-poisoned children. In fact, the governor was in Baltimore for a previously scheduled meeting with Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development Build to discuss the group's legislative priorities. The issue of lead paint poisoning came up only briefly at the meeting. The same article incorrectly quoted the Reverend Douglas Miles as telling the governor about the experience of Miles's grandchildren with lead poisoning. In fact, Miles did not speak to the governor about lead poisoning. The remarks quoted in the story were made in a separate interview with the Sun. Oh, that's like a convenient way of like going back on stuff that may or may not have actually happened. So this is it, Willie. We've got down to the nitty gritty about what David Simon is so pissed about.
We've cracked the code.
Yeah, so this is why David Simon was ready to name names,
yeah,
and then go enjoy the open bar, I'm presuming, at the reception after his talk at USC way, yeah, back when. But great stuff, you know. Maybe we'll relink it. I'll get back on the socials. Great. I got some stuff to gear it up. I'm just ready for us to drop.
Going to die.
We're going to drop these episodes. It's going to be amazing.
Try to tie it all in together, bud.
Yeah, this is crazy, man. But yeah, man, Alma goes to bat for Gus.
Yeah, she gets demoted to the Carroll County Bureau.
Yeah, and is there any significance there? I mean, she gets sent to ride the Carroll County boat, and John Carroll, the editor that, you know, was behind all this little weird stuff with Reverend Douglas and Jim Hayner and the lead. So what are you going to do, man?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Alma goes to bat for Gus. She tells Whiting and Klebanow about the empty notepad after Gus presents his findings from Robert Rudy and gets demoted himself. So, you know, human life matters less and less. Pulitzers are the real prize in life.
Yeah, man.
So, yeah, we're still... unfortunate set of circumstances that leads these two on a path that, you know, is not advantageous to their careers.
Exactly, you know.
But we do get a little bit of a catharsis in this storyline when McNulty does confront Scott.
Yeah. And yeah, he basically reveals his lies. We've all seen it. We've all, you know, like Willie said, it's, you know, a bit gratifying. And
yeah,
he knows why he's a liar, but can't figure out what the hell Scott's getting out of it. Like, kind of just said, you know, he's off to new heights while those who sought the truth are, you know, demoted.
Yeah. I mean, and then even in McNulty's case, he was using lies to get to the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
When, yeah, Templeton is just really opportunistic.
Well, he was using lies to get to the bag.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he got the bag, right? I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, even Rawl said it best, like, you did this for the money. You can't tell me otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
You're a C-word hair away from an indictment.
That's a classic line.
Yeah. But isn't that just really great that, it's from one liar to the other that's the most painful confrontation of all, because, like, this is, like, the one moment of vulnerability we see from Templeton where he's not just being a snake little rat.
Yeah.
Motherfucker, where he like actually seems like scared.
Yeah, he gets so scared he has to go home and take a doo-doo because his stomach
isn't feeling right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Klebanow upset his stomach.
Dookie, on the other hand, really, well, he visits his old school Tillman.
But Dookie's situation seems to have already rapidly deteriorated even from the last episode. Yeah, he already seems like in the throes of pretty, like, powerful drug addiction.
Yeah, man. Chasing that first high, I guess, right?
Yeah, with Principal Donnelly and Prez, like, both subtly making inferences with their eyes about his appearance and how he looks really beat up, and
it's different. It's worse than when he just had poor hygiene as a student.
I mean, yeah, that goes without saying, really. But it's like can't they do anything about it? Like, they see that this kid is in need, but Prez really took that advice to heart of, like, divorcing his feelings from his students and not getting too attached, and basically proclaiming, like, I'm probably never going to see you again after I get this money, after I give you this money.
Yeah, for all this talk that, like, Baltimore is a small town, you know? Seems pretty big for Presbo. I mean, he's just more focused now on, you know, lawn furniture and making sure other young black kids are in detention for hours on end.
Yeah, for playing Snatch Pops.
Yeah, he said Snatch Pops.
Yeah, he doesn't know about Snatch Pops.
He doesn't know about that. What's next? The kid says doorknob and, you know, sock someone, and then he's like, what, 2 months of detention?
Or he's going to flag people for giving medical misinformation by saying that if your hand is bigger than your face, you have cancer. What? Do you ever hear that one?
Oh, okay.
They say, like, if your hand is bigger than your face, you have cancer. So then they put their hand on their face and then you just hit their hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, he'll enter them into, like, some, citywide, like, database. Presbo. Yeah. What? So. He's not old enough, Dookie, to get a normal job, but he's way too old for anyone to, like, you know. I mean, I know this whole show's about the failure of the state and institutions and, you know, the gods won't save you. Yeah. But, I mean, I'm not saying that Dookie should be in, like, a group home like Randy, but is there not anything that could be done at this stage? He's like, what, 15, 16?
Colvin adopted Namie.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I know Carver, like, went through, like, he was really broken up that he couldn't take it upon himself to adopt Randy, but...
So, yeah, it's like, well, you know, I've amended myself for, like, shooting, you know, another person, another cop, killing them.
Blinded a kid.
Yeah, blinded a kid. And, well, I got the hang of it, as Dookie says. So, hey, this kid looks like he just, like, is newly addicted to some type of substance. I'm just going to give him more than enough money to potentially overdose or just, like, never come back from this, you know? Yeah. And who knows who's exploiting him. I mean, he sees it with his own eyes.
Yeah.
It's not suspicious that he's just, like, I'm not trying to say, you know, profile A-rabbers, but maybe... Prez really doesn't know what's up with them. I mean, come on. It's like, I don't know.
I mean, he knows. He was a fucking cop.
Like, yeah, I mean, he probably, like, beat up a A-rabber for just his horse having too loud a hoof.
Jesus. Yeah. Sorry. Is this like...
This is not the intended response Prez's last scenes are supposed to evoke.
Like,
we've seen this too many times.
Like, is this like, you know, this whole show has been trying to convince us that, like, Prez's arc is one of redemption because he goes through all these lessons, but is this, like, last episode trying to hint to us all that he's, like, just back where he started with, like, neglecting and abusing little kids, even from, like, the rhetoric of a caring teacher?
It's like the school to prison pipeline wasn't efficient enough. Like, we need actual police.
We're making jokes here, and it's more probably nuanced than we're giving it credit for.
Yeah,
that, like, Prez is caught between a rock and a hard place, but come on, man.
Yeah, I mean, giving $200 to do, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Man, that's crazy. But, well, it's almost like he's paying off, like, his conscience in a way. Just like, he could sleep better now knowing that, hey, I did everything. I gave him $200. Like, is his wife not going to check it? Like, is Prez a guy whose spouse doesn't, like, I mean, they have a joint banking account, or does he have his own little side thing? Like, is she not going to notice? Like, what the? Like, you just wait when your father-in-law finds out about this. No, don't tell him.
I bet you he's probably more freewheeling with his approach to the relationship with his father-in-law now that he's not relying on him for he's like, for employment.
He's probably asking Valchek if, you know, is your hand bigger than your face? And then Whack.
No, he cuts out the middleman and just goes straight for the punching.
He plays snatch pops now and they go out to Italian dinners in Southeast Baltimore.
Yeah.
God damn it, Roland. That's my chicken parm.
What the hell is wrong with this kid?
I don't give a fuck about snatch pops.
Yeah.
We should have done this more often.
Yeah, that's okay.
We shouldn't. Yeah, man, sad stuff. Well, you know, there's still one final scene with Dookie, but Marla Levy.
So Marlo is trying to work his magic with reducing the pain that Marlo and company are going to have to go through. And in like talking about through all this, they both kind of have a lightning bolt moment where they realize that there's something funny going on with the within the police department and how they could have gotten their code debunked so easily.
Who could have done it?
Yeah. And then, you know, of course they soon realize that Herc has made like a full and complete heel turn and he's now just like in bed with the criminals because of the job security that it gives him.
Yeah, it's like, this is great actually. Buying rounds for everyone.
The number I gave is gonna get me access to my boss's wife's delicious brisket. Always with the brisket. Can't get enough of Yvette's fucking brisket. He's always talking about the brisket. Levy is, that is.
Yeah. Herc would never say anything anti-Semitic ever. And his like cops would never make jokes about that. Just happened to be at Levy's house and do that.
Yeah.
That's gonna go. I want to see like an alternate scene, like with that dinner party.
Yeah, we never get to see Yvette.
I bet you there's some N bombs flying around.
I mean, Levy did refer to D'Angelo as "you people" in season one. Oh yeah, and so he smacks him. There's a lot of casual racism going on. Not even casual racism.
What's up with the? Yeah, we talked about that, and we're going to re-listen to episode one. I mean, no racism is casual. You're a racist piece of shit. That's yeah. what someone said about Rawls.
Yeah.
I remember when that was like a spicy take, and now it's like, oh, let's make fun of like Dookie's heroin addiction. No, we're not come down.
Yeah. But
never speak of them.
But
what's up with the person next to Herc in the prison?
So, yeah, through all like the backdoor dealings and whatnot, Levy basically breaks it down for Marlo that he's gonna like be free, but he's gonna have to give up the crown. He's gonna have to give up his gangster lifestyle and try to go legitimate with all these, you know, fake trout developers like Krawcheck and blah blah blah. You know, get everything that Stringer always wanted but can never achieve, and what Marlo achieves but doesn't even want. After like relaying all this information, Levy shows how appreciative he is of Herc, but there's this like mysterious figure in the holding cell next to him that like follows Herc on his way out, and we can't really he looks like a Proud Boy or like some sort of like white supremacist Nazi like prison. I don't know, like
I thought he looked more like Mankind or some like hobo.
Okay, yeah, I can see. Or I was gonna also say like, you know, some Charles Manson one. Yeah. It's just like, even in the commentary they're like, who is that? It is a mysterious little cameo shrouded in you know, we can't see his face, but he stalks Herc on the way out, and you know, that's just part of Herc's conscience stalking him as he continues to make bad decisions that are advantageous to his career but deleterious to his conscience. And his conscience makes the appearance in the form of a white supremacist whose face we can't see. No, I don't know.
Whatever. You want that brisket, don't you?
I just like the way I just
juicy.
Like, I don't know. I'm just rambling, but I just like the way that guy looked in his holding cell. So I thought I would comment on it.
This is good stuff.
But yeah, I wanted to ask you, is there something, so, well, let's move, let's keep talking a little bit. So, Chris has to do a life sentence. Monk is going to be in there for a while, but Cheese walks.
Cheese walks on the bail put up from Joe's house.
That's so messed up, man.
Yeah.
So showing no respect for his uncle.
Nope. But the Connect is being sold by Marlo to the remnants of the co-op, Slim, yeah. FFR, Fatface Rick, and another character who I don't know his name in the show, but got some intel on SB.
Clinton Shorty Buis.
Yeah, we don't do CBS, we do CSB. Clinton Shorty Buis, boys.
Yeah, but he was... do you have any intel on this guy? Because he was a local Baltimore legend.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had talked about him a little when we were at a Butchie's bar, and he was talking about Frank, like Pee Wee Matthews, I think, or that legendary like guy who just disappeared while he was on bond or something. But he was from New York, but they made him seem like he was from Baltimore. But I think in real life, that guy would do business or like hang out with guys like CSB. But rest in peace, you know. He's like,
yeah.
He
died like 9 years ago or something. But he was just kind of a beloved character in the whole Baltimore scene for almost being like a Renaissance man.
Yeah.
His claim to fame was his ability to comprehend and learn. He went to culinary art school. He was a fantastic dancer. He played the drums, saxophone.
All right. That's all, yeah, great information, man. But he sounds, you said he's a Renaissance man, so he's like the fully formed or like more authentic version. I don't know where I'm going. Got to be careful. He's like the Renaissance man version of Norris Davis. So instead of like for-profit college salesman gigs and throwing parties, for these drug dealer, this gentleman was working on his culinary skills and dance moves.
Yeah, he loved to have fun and he loved to do things for other people.
Yeah.
According to Rosa Pryor, who is an Afro columnist and author who once worked with some of Baltimore's best known entertainers. But he was great because he helped raise money for music scholarships for local children.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all coming from this Afro article that we found by Zachary Lester.
There you go, man. Now we're talking about this character in the last episode of The Wire.
Yeah.
Because he has some funny lines, kind of like very timely, statements.
He calls Slim Charles a sentimental motherfucker for costing them money when Slim executes Cheese in front of everybody. And what I got to say, it makes me happy to see Slim Charles, it's a mixed bag because it's part of, it's like the whole, Hitchcockian thing where, we want villains to succeed in, a certain aspect of it. Like, Slim Charles, oh, man, he's climbing the ranks. He's talking with the Greeks at the end of the show. Still, he's a killer and he's poisoning the community with hard drugs. But hey, it's not like I like that he's being rewarded for his hard work.
Yeah. I mean,
he's the Kima of the drug, drug world.
There you go. Everyone's always like, ah, man, I'd be Slim because he always kept it real and he never did this and blah, blah.
Yeah.
Did a lot. Did a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he did. So Marlo is working on selling the Connect to him and Fatfit, and then so there's a scene where they're trying to pool all their money in a random vacant parking lot, and Cheese is threatening Fatface Rick with a gun, and going on like a kind of like hate-filled tirade, which is quickly cut off by Slim Charles putting a bullet in his head, and Shorty Buiz calls him sentiment. This scene feels a little awkward to me in retrospect after seeing it several times, to how casually they react to somebody getting murdered in front of them and how quickly they all just like walk away and drive away without any plans to like cover up. Yeah, right. I mean, I don't know. Maybe, they're so desensitized to it by now that but it just seems, I don't know, it seems rather quick that they just kind of like move on to the next bit of business.
Well, I mean, they're not going to, you know, make a report. And I was kind of doing the same, like, oh, look, there are some row houses behind them in like the, you know, the shot. And then I realized like, oh, it's, they're all vacant. So it's like depressing. And yeah, at this point, you know, if you made it this far, I'm sure they're all seeing someone killed or killed someone.
But aren't they like at the least bit concerned about the legal implications? Because Fatface Rick even like flicks his cigarette down at the dead body of Cheese, and like Chris Partlow got convicted for lot less DNA than that with the killer Mike's step 10.
I mean, at the end of the day, if they pick him up, he's like, I didn't do it. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I'm splitting hairs here, like one of the hairs that was found at the crime scene of DeVar Manigault.
Love it.
But anyway, so Slim talking about Little Glenn?
I mean, we already went over this. I don't know. He mentions a random name, but yeah, man.
Some parallels with Marlowe and McNulty, where they're both men without a country, or they're not respected in the fields they want to be wearing the crown in, like as Marlowe is at that party with all the developers and businessmen, and he looks like he's like uncomfortably like unable to breathe or something. What it
is to get out of there. He's a dundada. He loves the smell of that gunpowder.
Oh yeah.
So, but I love how he still has to make up a lie with Levy. Like, he like tries to be polite. It's like, I gotta, and then, you know, he doesn't, I guess we can't pin like, oh, he made up a lie. Like, he's not being real, because Levy's like, oh, you need to use the restroom. It's like, yeah, sure, whatever. Okay. I'm going to go like hand to hand combat with like armed men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
it's pretty crazy.
I mean, it's just so comical to see him like try to be a part of normal society. Like, he can't even like excuse himself properly or like thank anybody for like the business connections. He does like awkward like finger gestures without saying much. Like, it's like the first time like we've actually seen him really kind of like vulnerable or uncomfortable, to the point where he has to like escape back to the streets to where he can feel like he can breathe again.
And just like taste his own blood.
Yeah. Gets excited about the knife and the gun. There's something in Truth Be Told. I can't remember, you know, I'm paraphrasing, of course, here, but it's like Marlowe has the Miltonian desire to he would rather rule in hell than be a servant in heaven.
Dude, I was just reviewing that at the end. I was like, I gotta do something. And you just recall that off top, man. That's amazing.
But it's kind of like he feels more like, you know, not to be too, but he's like in that, you know, skyscraper looking out at the, you know, beautiful view, drinking, or, you know, he has access to expensive champagne and all these delicious appetizers, and he's like, oh no, I can't be here, I gotta go back down to the ground level and, you know, fight some people for being on a corner that was previously mine. Yeah,
crazy stuff.
Yeah, but
what a psycho.
Marlowe, fantastic character, fantastic performance by Jamie Hector. We've loved every minute of it. Great stuff.
Yeah, man. But so the person who Cheese was supposed to get a hold of, Mike.
Get a hold of. He's supposed to kill him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Not going to happen now.
Yeah.
Marlo doesn't know that Cheese is dead, I'm assuming. So.
I mean, word will eventually get back to him probably, right?
They'll run into each other, but Yeah, he robs Vincent bareface and shoots him in the leg.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff, man. How they have to do real Norris like this, man.
Yeah.
And fake Trout Norris gets off with just a trip to Atlantic City, I'm assuming.
Yeah, Vincent, when he's face to face with Michaels pointing a shotgun at him, he's at first like dismissive, like, "You're just a boy. I mean, you're just a boy. You're not yet a man, but let me steer you in the direction of ITT Technical Institute."
Don't you want to get off of public assistance and, you know, be a man? Yeah.
Yeah, but Michael, you know, he doesn't really have any interest in furthering his education at this point when he's fully accepted the moniker of being the new Omar. And, you know, he's continuing the tradition of having the code of robbing from the rich and giving back to the needy, I guess. I don't know. This storyline feels a little weird. It feels like a little like fan service-y to me a bit. I don't know.
Hey, Bug needs some bands, man.
Yeah.
Howard County needs this influx of... That was a lot of money he left Bug with.
Yeah, really?
So, at this point, yeah. But it's, you know, I guess it's cool to think about. No, this is terrible. We don't need this crime in our society. But, I mean, he just, you know, he has somewhat of a code, right? He's made his case clear with the whole murdering for this and that. You know, just... Even Vincent's like, "He shot me in the leg." Yeah. I mean, if your victim can still like verbalize that, they're going to be all right, hopefully.
But Mike shot Vincent in the knee just like Omar shot what's-his-face in the knee in the first season, further reinforcing cyclical, circular, blah, blah, blah. Human life matters less and less. Power vacuums, tragedy.
Our state's less viable, so join a for-profit technical institute.
Yeah, this is all that everybody who's listening to us, this whole podcast project has just been one large misdirection to tell you to enroll in Trump University.
Exactly. Like everybody used to talk about that viral, you know, Everest College, Bay Area. Like, yeah. I mean, there was the guy who, like, you know, he's like in the hood and he's talking directly to you. Like, you know, but before that, there was Norris Davis. There was Vincent in Baltimore who's wearing probably a suit and tie, a starched button up shirt. You know, this guy's a legend. You can't just do him like that, David Simon.
I mean,
why did Vincent have a bone to pick later on? Norris Davis, David Simon beef. Next project coming to you soon.
Sure, okay. I feel like we're gonna get a message on Facebook from Norris Davis or something asking for like kickbacks for all the work we've done for him to get people to enroll in for-profit colleges.
Oh man, I want my money for our leads. Yeah. I've had to do worse for less.
Yeah. Anyway, should we move on to Reginald?
Reginald Cousin. I mean, Reginald. Yeah, man. We've talked about Fletch trying to sell the son. Yeah. Bubbles, you know, getting some solid, like, you know. There's a lot of communication. Like, you gave us some great insight over here about this wasn't really commonplace where the... subject, you know, wasn't necessarily always cued in on everything.
Yeah.
But whatever. I'm talking this to death for no reason.
No, that's okay.
Bubs and Waylon talk about bigger picture things like some guy named
Franz Kafka.
Yeah. Franz Kafka. You read him?
I read the Metamorphosis or whatever, the story about the guy who turns into a cockroach.
Oh, nice. I think I had to read some in a reader like in my first semester of or quarter school. And I was like, what the hell? Where am I? Like, how do all these kids know about, like, we're still 18 or 19, right?
Yeah.
Like, how does everyone know about this Kafka guy? I'm like, Snatch Pops.
Hey, that's my reader.
Yeah, Kafka. You guys want to go to late night dining hall? Woo!
This is, I mean, this is not the Literary Wire podcast, all right? No.
Hey, check out Rewire. Yeah. Friends over there.
They're, yeah, they've got that down on lock. We're all about Vincent Davis. Or no.
What are we about?
Yeah, we're all about Norris Davis and his plans to get everybody enrolled in for-profit colleges.
The state is not viable. Unviable.
I guess this is a time to announce that to pay attention to our corporate sponsor, DeVry University.
Yeah. Hey, but if you've been to ITT Tech and have debt, you can get loan discharge.
Yeah. But so yeah, in the midst of all this, with, you know, this whirlwind with Bubs's life getting back on track, with this story being written about him, and, you know, it's a very cathartic experience in one way, but he's concerned about his stuff being put out in the street. He's still trying to mend the relationship with his sister. And I don't know if you noticed in that scene when he brings the crabs home to his sister, there's a certain song playing in the background.
What is she listening to?
It's the Assume the Position by Lafayette Gilchrist.
Nice.
But that was also the ending credits music for The Deuce, which is like...
Oh, is that where it's familiar? I was like, what is this?
Yeah, it's great stuff. Like,
crazy.
David Simon talked about, like, oh yeah, like, I know that I had to have this guy's music in this scene right here. He's like the perfect mixture of go-go music and funk and like all this. And if you listen to the track, it's a really neat, it's great music, and you watch The Deuce and you grow to love the song.
But yeah, he's a new man, Bubs.
He crosses that threshold and is finally able to eat dinner with his sister and niece in the closing montage. Hopefully, at some point, he gets reunited with his kid that we never get to see. And
we never see
his kid, who we don't know is a boy or a girl, right?
It's a son, isn't it? Like Keyshawn or Deshaun? Well, I don't want to.
Hopefully he'll join them at dinner one time.
Talking about montage. Oh, yeah. Anything about, I mean, you know, great scene. Speaks for itself.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Yeah.
it's on the show.
Yeah. Check
it's
out
in
this,
the show.
Check out this like 5-second clip.
Yeah. We'll post it. Nah. Talk about cyclical nature, man.
Yeah.
This ending scene. I mean, thankfully it goes by quickly enough because McNulty is pulled over obstructing traffic.
Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah.
But same deal, right? It's just like promotions.
Yeah.
Governors, you know, mayors become governors. Rat fuckers become commissioners.
Yeah.
Falchuk. Dookie slamming the dope.
Oh, man. So hard to see. Yeah.
All right, man. Yeah, lots of stuff going on at Jessup and the cut.
Yeah. Chris and Weebe are getting along. Where's Avon with them? He's not hanging out.
He's just playing video games, eating crab cakes and KFC. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Kennard goes to jail.
Kennard goes to jail. Daniels becomes a defense attorney. Rhonda's a judge. So, yeah, there's that ending montage. Rawls becomes state police superintendent. There's shots of all the different parts of the city that we've come to know and love throughout the last 5 seasons. But before that, like before like the epilogue even starts, when the serial killer story is like brought to a close, there is like this musicless montage of like all the different scenes of Baltimore at sunrise and sunset at nighttime, and plays out with just us gazing upon the majestic beauty of a city that can sometimes be considered in turmoil and sometimes makes progress, but is often at war with itself. So it's just a nice little piece of a symphony of the city, as they would call it. I don't know. It kind of reminds me of like a Berlin symphony of the city. the movie that was like a wordless feature-length film just all about how a city works and whatnot. And I think it was nice that we got a little bit of avant-garde stuff going on there at the end, before the epilogue kicks off. So I always really love that great little montage, and I don't quite know how to express my feelings about it because I kind of feel like it just speaks for itself, and it's like it's a neat way of helping pass the time. It's not like a montage summing everything up like the ending montage is, but it does help, like, you know, connote the passage of time and stuff. So yeah, Berlin Symphony of a City by Walter Ruttmann is a movie that shows us one day in Berlin, the rhythm of that time, starts at the earliest morning and ends in the deepest night. So that's a great movie from 1927 that you should all check out. All right, do we have anything else to say about the cyclical nature of capitalism or, you know, city government or the police or education, the docks, newspaper?
City skyline.
Yeah.
Mr. Bobbles.
Yeah.
I think you did a number on all that while I was away for a moment.
Yeah.
All right. I couldn't make it, man.
I'm right there with you. As soon as we're done recording,
just do your best. Stay out of the system. And if all else fails, just, go forge your own path at a local for-profit college.
Or take up what is the specific trade or craft that Freeman takes up?
Figurining.
Whittle tiny furniture and you'll, you know, end up
getting
with a hot stripper who changes her ways for you. And
it's half your age.
Yeah.
And or go to culinary classes and enjoy dance.
Yeah, become a local legend.
There you go. That's all it gets. I'd like to leave it there, yeah.
Yeah.
Become a local legend.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Or, you know, take a job in the evidence control unit, because that beats working.
There you go. Let's get it. Let's do it, man. This is fun.
Yeah. All right. Anything else? Speak now or forever, you know, feel the regret of not saying your last 2 cents.
I like how you left it. We'll just leave it there.
All right. Thank you so much, everybody, to anybody who's toughed it out with us for so long. We know we got a little crazy and at times incoherent, but to our diehard fans, even our casual listeners, if we said anything that was remotely interesting to you, we appreciate you. All our donors, so great of you to show faith in us. We're very grateful to you. Don't know how exactly things are going to shape up for us in the future. We'll probably keep posting, so please feel free to follow us on all social media. The Gods Will Not Save You, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Yeah. Thanks for showing love to all of those who've, done the same with us. Willie, I appreciate it. And yeah, like Willie said, man, appreciate everything as far as our support's concerned. And it's meant a lot. This has been fun. We've learned a lot about The Wire, stuff that we never thought we would ever uncover, and more about each other, things that we would have rather not uncovered. No, but I'm going back to school. Got a call lined up with old ND Norris.
Yeah,
Davis, of course, not fake Trout Norris, but all that aside, it's been real. And please, if you have any other comments or questions, concerns, we'd love to hear from you at thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. Always, welcome feedback. You know how much we loved, getting into some reviews, way back when and earlier seasons. And we'd love to hear, anything that you might not feel comfortable posting on social medias or on our Apple Podcast reviews, not Spotify. So yeah, shout, give us a shout.
Yeah.
godswantosavey@gmail.com.
Yeah, it's been a great project. Certainly has given a lot of like meaning and shape to my life at a time when things seem crazy with this pandemic and we are doing this over Zoom.
Yeah.
I feel like we've come a long way since then. So very grateful to have a fan base, no matter how, no matter the size. We're glad that we've been able to interact with some people.
And, you know, you never know. We'll, like where that may lead. We never 10 years from now.
Sure.
Might have a podcast about the podcast.
There you go.
Hopefully not, but
we haven't done this in a while, but I would like to give a shout out to Mostart,
yeah,
who did all of our original music, the intro and outro and all the bumpers. You can check out his entire catalog at mostart.com.
Yeah, and thanks so much again to our bud Andre, who provided us with really unique designs for our emblem, some original artwork. Check them out, you know, Andre Tesnes. Thanks.
Great stuff that he did there. They both helped us make this more legitimate than I know I am. Anyway.
No fake trout activities there.
All right, I guess that's it. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thanks a lot. Take it easy.